Welcome to the Farcast, coming to you every week with insiders and experts to give you insight into the changing economic world. And now, here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to the Farcast. Thanks so much for joining us again this week, July the 29th. So now we finished half the year, basically, plus 1 month, 7 months through 2020. I saw someone send a note saying, dear warranty department, I've had enough of 2020. I'd like to return it, and I'd like my money back. That feels pretty true for pretty much everyone except stock investors who have enjoyed a pretty good year in spite of all of the news, the lack of earnings, the COVID, the shutdowns, the everything, and stock prices are doing pretty well. One of the reasons might be that the Fed is meeting today, and the Fed has met consistently, and the Fed has done extraordinary things. We will hear from the Federal Reserve later today, their meeting, and hear what they have to say about what they're still prepared to do. And of course, we have earnings news coming out, General Motors, General Electric, Boeing, General Motors and Boeing and General Electric, mixed reports, largely negative, certainly Boeing and GM, and their stocks are called a good deal higher. GE beat on the top line, missed on the bottom line. Larry Culp says that's okay. That stock is also called higher. Every week we bring you Wall Street, Washington, and the world. We find some of the nation's leading experts who can provide us insights and guidance as we try to think about how we can continue forward with our investment portfolios, with our strategies, and try to formulate more intelligent views of the world. We are in for a treat today, ladies and gentlemen, a Farcast fan favorite. And thank you for your notes about Jim Labenthal when we've had him on before. You're very complimentary. And ladies and gentlemen, you should be. Jim Labenthal is a partner at Cerity Partners, manages U.S. equity portfolios for clients and advises them on asset allocation, financial market conditions. You've seen him on CNBC. Take it off of mute. Listen to my friend Jim Labenthal, and it's a treat to welcome you back. Jim, good morning.
Michael, thank you, and what an intro. I don't know how you packed all of that into that tight introduction, but it explains why you're having a busy day and I'm having a busy day. Let's face it, there's a lot going on. This is the best way to start, you and me figuring it out.
We'll figure it out, and maybe our listeners will be, we hope, a little smarter when we finish. With all of this going on, Jim, and I just heard Andrew Ross Sorkin say something. We don't have EBITDA anymore. We have EBITDAC, which is earnings before, EBITDA, interest, taxes, amortization, depreciation, amortization, and COVID. We've now tacked on COVID. So we've come up with a number that sounds to me to be entirely meaningless. What are you making of markets here at the end of July and coming into August with all of these, with the CARES program expiring this Friday, Jim?
Yes, and, you know, I think the lack of a stimulus bill so far has maybe caused a little bit of consternation in the stock market. You know, the last couple of weeks have been wobbly, actually at the top, at the leadership. That said, I think the market expects, I expect a deal will be struck. I mean, it's crazy to think that it won't. That would be like going back to the fall of 2008 when TARP was voted down and Congress learned its lesson very quickly. Now, you put that all together.
Jim, Congress learning its lesson? Really? You think that happens? That's an optimist. I'm a lifelong Washingtonian. You see, I was born. I went to high school three blocks from the Capitol building. Okay, we're going to go with your optimism that they've learned their lesson. I'm not as convinced.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. Let's take your lack of conviction on what I said and build it into something bigger, which is we're about to enter August, the dog days of summer. Trading usually gets light. You usually go with the flow, which in the case of the stock market, as you pointed out, is to the high side. It keeps getting higher and higher.
Yeah.
I think what the question is what happens, late August into the fall? I mean, we've got one heck of an election coming up, to say the least. Can't wait to see what the conventions are like. I mean, the vitriol is going to be through the roof. And, you know, you mentioned EBITDAC. The coronavirus isn't going away. I wish it were, but it's not.
Yeah, right.
We've seen the reopening spike. That's starting to ease in those hard-hit southern states, but it's starting to pick up in the Midwest states. So it's just not going away, and that places a lot of pressure on a lot of the travel stocks, entertainment stocks, you know, things like Disney, just as an example. That pressure is not going away, and it doesn't look like it's going to go away before the end of the year until and unless we get a vaccine.
You know, Jim, Google announced yesterday that they're going to keep employees working from home until July of 2021. Other companies are delaying their openings, not making announcements, but this continue to work from home thing is also a headwind to the economy. I mean, it's kind of up there. I mean, economically, with the not opening of schools, it creates its own set of headwinds. So if you have those 100,000, 200,000 employees, however many there are at Google, I don't know how many employees there are at Google. It's got to be over 100,000.
I think I read 200,000.
200,000. They're not going to the office, right? So they're not putting miles on their cars. They're not paying. They're not stopping at Starbucks to get their latte before they get on the train. They're not buying lunch at the restaurant next door. They're not buying clothes to go to the office. They're not wearing out shoes. They're not doing these things. Economic activity is down. It's going to stay down. We have this headwind in place. In our need for an organic economy and for organic demand, which has been so elusive, really, in spite of all the stimulus, what I've suggested before, Jim, with great temerity, is that I think Milton Friedman actually missed it, that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary event. It's not unless you can stimulate demand. And if you can't stimulate demand, you don't stimulate inflation. So where can we find demand going forward? Just as a very broad base, if we don't have a growing economy, if we don't have demand, what's this economy do over the next 12 months?
Well, it transforms is the answer. It transforms and it accelerates.
What a great answer. I love that answer. Explain that. This is cool. This is great.
Sure. You know, as I was listening to you, I could have postulated on the fact that my office is across the street from Brooks Brothers. I've been into the office once in the past 3 months. Poor Brooks Brothers in bankruptcy. But you know what? Let's not focus on the negative. The economy always adjusts to crises like this. Now, this is one heck of a big crisis, but we're seeing it already, right? Work from home is benefiting things like Zoom, Microsoft, Amazon. And it is transforming the economy. There will be winners and losers. And if you look at, I'm not picking on brick and mortar retail, but if you look at brick and mortar retail, that's an obvious loser. If you look at companies that have, besides Amazon, have great online presences, whether it's Target, whether it's Walmart, you know, those are the ones that are going to survive. Now, Michael, this economy, when we look at it 2 years from now, is not going to look like the economy that you and I grew up in. You know, I don't think there are going to be as many business lunches. My poor dry cleaner, I feel so bad every time I walk in. He says,
right?
Where are your suits? I say, I'm wearing them like, you know, once every 2 weeks.
Right.
Look, it's going to transform. It's going to be painful. This is where the government has to step in and help in the transition. Frankly, they have, both on the fiscal side and the monetary side.
We've got a lot of the, speaking of those leaders of the Microsoft and all of the others, the Zooms, Apple, others. We've got Tim Cook and all of the big tech giants testifying on Capitol Hill. There's a great pressure on these guys right now that they've become too powerful, that they've become monopolies. They have too much control, too much insight into data. Congress is going to bash them here. What do you make of that? Does that have an effect on these stock prices?
Well, it hasn't so far. I mean, let's just speak factually. I think I can say that factually. It has not
Yes.
so far. But on the other hand, this issue is not going away. And it will get bigger depending on the outcome of the presidential election. But certainly if Mr. Biden wins and some of the people who are possibly going to be in his candidate are going to go after these companies right away. Now, let me make the bigger point, which is this. yes, regulation can pull a Microsoft or an AT&T and, you know, try to break up these companies. I don't think that's going to be as quick and as effective as what's going on with Facebook right now. I think when you see customers saying, we are not going to advertise on your platform,
yes,
your behavior, I think that's the only thing that matters. On that note, I will say I'm surprised that Facebook has hung in there, because this is, you know, this is anti-apartheid 30, 35 years ago. That's what got regime change there, was when divestiture occurred. We're steadily marching in that direction concerning behavior from these companies.
Facebook, relative to the other lists, for the other, a lot of the other sort of FANG or MFANG stocks, or other, it's not quite as expensive, though, as those other stocks. I mean, it really does have earnings, and it does have earnings growth. So there is some there underneath. I want you to, I talked to a fairly senior person at Wells Fargo on, was it Sunday night? I guess it was Sunday night. And this guy gave me a completely different take. He said, Michael, I want you to get ready for a red wave in November. I said, I beg your pardon. He said, a red wave. The Republicans are going to win the House, the Senate, and the executive branch. And I said, in 2020 was my response. You mean this November? He said, yes. He said, the civic unrest and things like Portland and that are going on in other cities are going to inspire a need for a strong leader, law and order response. This is going to play to the Republicans' advantage. People are going to start to feel threatened, and when they feel threatened, they're going to vote for safety, and you're going to see the Republicans do very well. Now, I'm going to tell you, because we're a little tight on time, my quick reaction, which was I don't think so. But it made me stop to think, Jim, because if you had told me 4 years ago, absolutely, Michael, that Donald Trump was going to win this election, stock markets were going to rally after that, I would have given you the same response. I would have said, 2016, you mean this year? You mean Hillary Clinton's not going to win? What are you, out of your mind? Everybody knows Hillary Clinton's going to win. So when I hear absurd sort of forecasts for things politic, I never write them off anymore, only because I've seen too many wild and crazy things. What do you make of that?
I think it is absolutely possible, all right? And you cannot rule anything out, not just because this is 2020, the year that, you know, I don't even know how to describe it. I was almost,
yes,
going to say we haven't had locusts yet, but Africa has had locusts. Anyway, moving on from that, it is distinctly possible. I mean, you remember the bus interview with Mr. Trump, I think 2 weeks before the election, and everybody wrote him off, right? Saturday Night Live had a hilarious skit of Hillary Clinton dancing after that news. You cannot rule out the possibility that the Republicans come marching back. And also, we should point out, and you as a Washington denizen know this well, we're 3 months from the election. That's a long time. We haven't even
long
had the conventions. Anything can happen. It's absolutely right. If the election were today, I don't think that's the outcome, but anything can happen.
Anything can happen. We're watching prices. We're coming through all of this. We've got political experts coming up, and we've been talking about China with Les Munson and Dan Mahaffey. Fascinating what Les Munson has been saying about China's agenda, what they're trying to do. We're seeing what's happening in Hong Kong. I read overnight that basically Hong Kong has been returned to its position behind the Great Wall of China, that they that control is returning very quickly. With all of this uncertainty, Jim, as we look forward, Fred and Ethel are looking at their at ages 60 and 62 and thinking about retirement. They're looking at their 401ks. They're looking at these high prices. They're still contributing to their 401ks, and they look at you and they say, Mr. Labenthal, what do we do now?
Stop looking is the answer.
Avert your eyes.
I'm willing to bet you often give the same advice. Look, 60, 62, that's the new 50, right?
Right, absolutely.
Fred and Ethel have a long time to go, and we just agreed this economy will adjust, so will the stock market. it'll adjust to whatever comes out of the November elections. And if you look 5 years from now, you're going to be happy that you own stocks. The composition of the stock market will change, just like the composition of politics and society will change. But we will grow. This is not end of days. This is a bad year, but not end of days. So stop looking every day. And if you're going to look, look forward 5 years.
I think that that is some of the best advice that you're going to hear anywhere, ladies and gentlemen. It's stop looking. If you do look, think about 10 years, 5 years ahead, because this economy will adjust. Wise words, you can always get them from our friend Jim Labenthal from Cerity Partners. You can see him today on CNBC from noon until 1 o'clock. You can see him again Friday with me on CNBC. God, how exciting is that? And can you hardly wait till Friday when Labenthal and Farr are going to be on CNBC together at noon, when most of you are heading to the beaches, if you're wise and lucky enough to do that. All right. Jim Labenthal, thank you so much for joining us on the Farrcast. We're going to be right back with Mahaffey and Les Munson. We're getting into China. We're getting into Washington. We're going to talk vice presidential picks. We're going to talk about congressional testimony, all when we come back on the Farrcast.
Thank you for joining us on this week's Farrcast. We'd like to invite you to follow Michael on Twitter and LinkedIn. On his social media feed, you'll find links to all of Michael's media appearances, articles he's been quoted in such newspapers as The Wall Street Journal and Washington Post, and of course, the Farrcast. Additionally, Michael shares some of the articles we are reading at Farr Miller in Washington every morning that we feel have bearing on the investing landscape. That's Michael_K_Farr on Twitter and Michael Farr on LinkedIn. And now, back to Michael and the Farrcast. Welcome back to the Farrcast. And now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. We're having a great Farrcast this morning. Jim Labenthal from Cerity Partners and, of course, CNBC regular on the Halftime Report. Just terrific. He's got such great common sense, straightforward, is telling us that the economy over time here will adapt, will continue to figure a path forward, that growth may be coming from new areas. We'll see companies that weren't necessarily thriving in a pre-COVID world begin to thrive in a post-COVID world. And some of those companies that were thriving will continue to suffer, of course, in the travel and leisure and entertainment industries. I drove by the theaters the other day, a big bank of theaters down here in Rehoboth. They are playing every old movie. I don't know who's going, but the original Bambi, I think, is on the is up on the sign out front on the marquee. So we will see things like Star Wars 1, whatever doesn't cost them any money. I think they've got on there, which is, you know, all right. There's an approach. Ladies and gentlemen, what a great treat now. We're going to, as we go to figuring out what's happening in Washington and the world, to bring insights to our listeners and our investors, we are now joined by our friend and senior political analyst, Dan Mahaffey, from the Center of the Study of the Presidency and Congress. You get to hear Dan every week. He is so generous with his time to join us and provide us with his brilliant thoughts and analysis. Also, Lester Munson, principal at the International BGR Group, leading government relations firm in Washington. Yes, that means he's a lobbyist. He was worked on Capitol Hill, was in the executive branch, is an insider's insider on Capitol Hill in the government. One of the clearest thinking and nicest guys you're going to meet in Washington, D.C., too. We were talking about China last week. The discussions were so good and so helpful, and we heard from so many of you. Thank you for your notes. Thank you for your feedback and text. We've got these guys back, and we're going to continue these discussions plus more as we welcome them back. Welcome, Dan. Welcome, Les.
Thank you, Michael.
Well, we're very glad you guys are here. Dan, let's start with you. Quickly give us a recap of what you're seeing in Washington this morning. The Federal Reserve is meeting. Biden's getting ready to pick a candidate. We have the tech titans from Google to Apple, Facebook, Amazon, all of them testifying on Capitol Hill under threat, under pressure. Tell us what you're seeing going on right now. And the president yesterday seemed to still be talking about hydroxychloroquine, which I was thought we were over that, but apparently we're not. So tell me, I'm confused by Washington again, Dan.
It's a recurring challenge where the for the president and his advisors, his campaign team, where they want him to shift focus, there's an inability to move away and sometimes even worse, double down on old positions. You know, even if perhaps he can't admit he's wrong, can they move away quietly? He just doesn't seem to be able to do that and get able to turn the page on some of those controversies.
I'm sorry to start off on a tangent here, Dan, and let's just jump in here. What in the hell is it about hydroxychloroquine? Why is this so important?
I think it's become a shibboleth for who's a true believer.
We need another one? how many shibboleths for the true believers do we need? There seem to be plenty, and all of them seem to be, you know, be popular.
Well, it's like the power of positive thinking versus the New England Journal of Medicine.
I totally agree with Dan. This is Trump's way of saying there we should be optimistic and our ingenuity will get us out of this thing. It's shorthand for it's not all doom and gloom. You don't have to sit in your houses. We'll figure something out on the science that will get you back in the economy. It's a shorthand way of doing it. It's a bumper sticker. It's a little bananas, but that's okay. It's a very quick way of being an optimist in all of these things.
All right.
No, and I think it's true that there's an optimism. They want to show that there are solutions, that there's action being taken, and it was a very easy way to stockpile a potential treatment quickly. But there's other ones we've seen too, with some of the other remdesivir, other things that could be being done that we know are effective and innovative that could at least show that they're taking it seriously rather than falling back on that shorthand.
All right. Well, we'll continue to watch all of this. Tech titans, does this go anywhere? Our investors do really care about a lot of these stocks. These have been the stocks that have led this market. You know, Congress can stomp all they want, but they better not kill this golden goose.
Well, and that's a challenge because it's the love-hate relationship we have with these companies in our everyday lives, from public policy. Look, we love Prime Amazon, whether we're a consumer or whether we're the Department of Defense. These companies have a vital role to play. You see Facebook, again, the challenges with what they're doing to moderate speech, election interference, those issues come up. But a lot of this is really show hearings that Congress likes to do to show that they're moving on this. And these companies are going to be in the crossfire from both sides.
This is theater?
Yes, it is theater. It's largely theater, and it's not even good theater because it's all going to be on Cisco WebEx.
Okay, fine. We're not going to worry about this. You agree it's theater, Les?
It's theater for now. Dan is entirely correct. But if they're as they flail around in public in the spotlight and they figure out an approach to these issues that has broad appeal in the middle, then it's suddenly not going to be a show and it's going to be more of a serious policy initiative. Right now, it's kind of the extremes on either side that are pushing for these seemingly crazy reforms of free enterprises.
And again,
I wouldn't totally dismiss it.
And going off in two very different directions. The right is all about media bias. The left is all about antitrust. So there's no overlap in the middle for them to actually take action on it yet.
Which may end up being the best case for these companies themselves. A couple of other things going on in Washington this week, not to mention the background music of China all the while, as Hong Kong seems to be returning behind the Great Wall of China, as one columnist wrote that I read overnight. Before we get to China, though, I want to go to the Attorney General's testimony. He appeared on Capitol Hill. What did you make of that, Dan? Is this more theater? Is there anything substantive there with Attorney General Barr and his being questioned over being sort of just a Trump patsy?
Look, I think Attorney General Barr is going to continue to be a loyal player for the administration and a unapologetic defender of their policies and Attorney General Barr's views on executive power. The Democrats up there, they wanted to use this as an opportunity to go through a long-standing litany of complaints as well as the current crises they see on the streets. But short of a put-up-or-shut-up moment where Congress, if the House is actually going to bother to try to impeach the Attorney General, which is a slim-to-none proposition on this calendar and with everything going on, I don't think it's more than just show on either side and trying to get sound bites for either side to can and put out in November.
Yeah, I think Barr, he's a pro. He's an old pro. He handled these attacks pretty deftly. And I think he made the Democrats realize they don't have a long way to go on this. Frankly, eight years ago or whenever it was, the Republicans did a better job of going after Eric Holder. This was pretty weak sauce from the Dems.
More theater on Capitol Hill. That's interesting for all the headlines that both of these stories are getting. Mitch McConnell has been trying to corral the Republicans to make sure we get some sort of a stimulus bill out. The president said it wasn't worth paying attention to, which I thought was odd and interesting, but that's basically what he said. Are they going to get something done here? We have the CARES Act that is expiring this Friday.
Well, look, I think it's never a good sign when the first thing the Senate Majority Whip, Republican John Thune, says when they come out of lunch is that members are instructed to speak to amongst themselves before they speak to the media, which is, one, no senator in the history of the Republic has ever done that. And two, that it just shows how scattershot the GOP conference is on this. You have Republicans in very vulnerable seats and seats that are becoming vulnerable that you didn't think. Think Iowa, think Georgia, think even Lindsey Graham starting to worry about how competitive his race is going to be in South Carolina. And they're getting calls. If you talk to some of these senators behind the scenes, their offices are basically now field hospitals for constituent services when it comes to getting PPP, getting loans processed, worrying about closures. And so they're in these situations of needing to do something, but the divisions within the Republican Party really put Democrats in the driver's seat on this, as well as the president's hands-off attitude. It doesn't bring any of the heft to White House. And puts McConnell in a strange position, too, when it's basically saying Meadows and Mnuchin go negotiate with Pelosi, and then I have to figure out how to get this garbage dumped through the Senate.
So, Les Munson, how do you get this garbage dumped through the Senate? And will it matter? Will Nancy Pelosi care whatever they put through the Senate?
She will. She will care. The person who's kind of in the Capford seat is really Chuck Schumer, I think. Mitch McConnell has 53 senators on his side. He needs 60 votes to get something through the Senate. He's probably got 40 Republicans right now, or somewhere, so give or take three or four. He's got about 40 Republicans. He needs 20 more votes. Those are going to come from Chuck Schumer. The more the dollar figure on the stimulus or on the emergency supplemental goes up. Right now it's at $1 trillion. It's only $1 trillion.
It's just a trillion.
As that number goes up, right, as that number goes up, you gain Democrats, but you lose Republicans. So is there a sweet spot between, let's say, 1.5 and 2.5 trillion where you can get to 60 votes in the Senate? My bet would be that's doable, and that Nancy Pelosi will take whatever comes out of the Senate with that figure and pass it through the House, and it'll go to the president. That'd be my bet right now.
How long does that take?
It's going to take probably 2 more weeks.
Okay. The first half of August, but something gets done then. Okay. All right. Well, that sounds certainly positive. We'll see how it all continues to play out in Washington, D.C. And I know one more thing before we go to China. Joe Biden had a pretty good press conference yesterday. Was it yesterday that I saw that? It looked pretty good. And he says he's going to, by a week from Friday, there we go, there's the headline, going to announce his vice presidential running mate. Any ideas? Is the Vice President Biden's position strengthened, weakened, or unchanged?
So there's a challenge. I think we've discussed this previously. He continues to benefit from the fact that the focus is on President Trump. He has carefully managed events that are going well. There's still a challenge for him, although they've really closed the money gap as well. That's been something that's been surprising to see. He's kicked the tires proverbially on quite a few of these potential running mates. I think you have a short list that includes people like Tammy Duckworth, Karen Bass. I think also you probably include Elizabeth Warren, although there's questions about where she would be most effective in an administration. But I think they're narrowing this down, and I think trying to avoid the pitfalls, although I think perhaps, too, they overthink it, because we tend to see lately that the, unless it's something like Sarah Palin, where it changes the entire momentum of the candidacy, that the vice presidential pick doesn't weigh too much on voters' opinions these days.
Les Munson, that's going to be true with Joe Biden? I mean, people think that he might be shaky in terms of his cognitive ability. Doesn't his vice presidential pick have greater weight in this election?
Well, that may be true, and he's going to need someone who can speak in paragraphs and look competent and responsible, because people are going to be afraid that if Biden wins, he won't last the whole term, or that he'll be a one-term president and you're looking at a VP who really needs to be able to step into the office. Joe Biden has done something that is a brilliant move in politics, which is to lower expectations. Right now, if he comes out and has a press conference and doesn't make any mistakes, it's viewed as a huge victory. This is something George W. Bush was the master of back in 2000. It's an asset for him, and he's got to hold on to that as long as he can. I'd keep, in terms of the VP slot, I'd keep an eye on Val Demings. She's very good on camera. She's from Florida. She's got a law enforcement background. She's got a little bit of charisma. My money's on her.
I think Val Demings is a good pick. I think Tammy Duckworth, though, has the foreign policy chops, as well as a relatively non-controversial resume when it comes to stances on issues.
And an amazing personal story.
Exactly.
An amazing personal
an
story.
An amazing narrative. And I think, too, that Lester raises also a good point, too. It's a, why does the Trump administration also keep helping Joe Biden lower expectations in these things? Because either Biden could have a mediocre debate and look fantastic, or I hear too, which as we get closer to this, does Biden say no tax returns, no debate to Trump?
Some find some excuse as a reason to not show up at that debate for the president. Might be the wisest thing if he could pull it off, if the public would let him get away with it. All right. Well, we'll see where all of this goes. We're hanging on the edges of our respective seats.
Once again, we are happy to have you with us on the Farcast as we learn more about the world around us by discussing it with some of the best minds on Wall Street and Washington for their insights and opinions on evolving events that impact the U.S. economy and your investing landscape. In addition to working as the CEO and president of Farr Miller in Washington, hosting the Farcast, and appearing on CNBC, Michael Farr is an in-demand speaker, having appeared at such venues as the YPO Economic Summit, the University of Delaware Economic Forecast, the Memphis Economic Club, and the Mathison Financial Conference. If you would be interested in Michael speaking at your upcoming event, please contact me, Harry Jennings, at hjennings@farrmiller.com. We are booking now for events in late 2020 and into 2021. And in the age of COVID, we can arrange for virtual events where your organization can watch remotely and participate in Q&A sessions following. Thanks for listening. And now back to our special extended episode with Lester Munson and Dan Mahaffey. Thank you for joining us on the Farcast. And now back to your host, Michael Farr.
And if you saw Steve Perlstein's column in the Washington Post over the weekend, I found it actually chilling as he went on to enumerate the various things that he believed would be rolled back should you get a blue wave. He went on to say that the blue wave would repeal every deregulatory initiative of the Trump administration. They would repeal the Trump tax cuts. They would repeal the tax loopholes that benefit hedge fund managers. They would restrict buybacks. They would tax financial transactions to discourage this high-frequency trading on Wall Street. They would triple, check this out, triple the IRS budget for audits of corporate tax returns, overseas tax shelters, launch aggressive antitrust cases against these tech giants who are testifying today on Capitol Hill yesterday. They would reform the bankruptcy code. They would raise the minimum wage. They would regulate for the first time the shadow banking system and derivatives markets. Actually, a lot of these things are not awful ideas, and regulating that shadow banking system so we have some visibility into it, I think, would be helpful. That was a big problem in 2008 and 2009. There were these huge pools of money and debt that were considered off-balance sheet items for banks. I'd never heard of them before. So like a sieve. Well, they had a $1 billion sieve, Michael. I said, what's a sieve? I mean, I've been doing this for decades. I don't know what these things are. I'm actually an expert at this. I'd never heard of it. Well, it's a special purpose investment vehicle, and it's an off-balance sheet item, and it's billions of dollars off-balance sheet for a bank. I don't know how those things happen. Price caps on prescription drugs and medical devices, overturning Supreme Court decisions limiting lawsuits. I don't know how you necessarily overturn the Supreme Court decisions, but and requiring disclosure of corporate political spending and all the others. Anyway, it was fairly chilling. We'll see what's at stake, but as Jim Labenthal said, the U.S. economy and the American people have always been able to adapt, and things have been able to continue forward. Gentlemen, let's now go to China, as promised. It does seem that the retaking of Hong Kong has happened, and there seems to be more news about the threat represented by Huawei and 5G. Let me start with you on China. Where do you see what's happening? And the Chinese seem to be having a lot of success with their agenda.
China is taking advantage of the pandemic across the board. They're moving against their neighbors. They moved into Hong Kong. They're cracking down in Xinjiang province, which is their far western province, largely Muslim. They are engaging in border disputes with their neighbors to the south. They are being more aggressive in the South China Sea, and they are asserting themselves across the board in international fora with the UN, its related agencies, in trading organizations. They are pressing their case now. It is perhaps premature. The U.S. is at long last responding, if not comprehensively, then spasmodically, but you're seeing a lot of developments. Australia is taking a little bit of a harder line. Even the EU has announced some extremely modest, of course, because it's the EU, sanctions over Hong Kong. Secretary of State Pompeo made a big speech. The U.S. has organized itself legally over the South China Sea, assertions by China in a way that the U.S. hasn't done before. So you're seeing a more of a reaction from the West, but it's still a reaction. We talked about this last week. China's been driving events. The West has been responding. What we should be looking for is that moment when the West starts driving the agenda and China has to react to that. I don't know how far away that is, but we're certainly not there yet.
Dan?
Well, I think that's right? And I think I'd go a little further and with the slight critique of that it's the Chinese have also looked to a vacuum of leadership in the West. And I'm not going to blame that entirely on President Trump, as some of his adversaries were. But you see institutions like the G7 have fallen down. The Western world, I think, failed to recognize the changing course of China. The period of engagement that had been worth a try. It had been truly worth a try. I don't think you can besmirch those who thought that openness and engagement with China would change the course of relations. But a true realization, too, that Xi Jinping has broken away from some of the models that have allowed China to hide its strength, bide its time and capabilities, as Deng Xiaoping so famously put it. And the question is, does that provoke, in a sense, a immune response, for lack of a better term, in the international system that gets Western countries, democracies, other neighbors of China to recognize that this is not the same Beijing that you're playing with in 2000 or 2005?
Les Munson, this seems to be a very Machiavellian China. Damn the torpedoes. The end clearly justifies the means, and screw you if you don't like it. Where does this end?
Well, that's a great question. And I'm not even sure it's working out terrifically for China right now. They are, as Dan alluded to, they're creating a reaction among their neighbors, among other countries who are very concerned about the way China's behaving. China being very aggressive now has kind of pushed into the background the fact that the pandemic, the certain amount of the responsibility for the pandemic lies with China. It originated in Wuhan. The initial Chinese response to the pandemic was certainly not good for the rest of the world. That's a huge concern. China has done a good job of, from its perspective, of managing that and trying to turn what is a terrible situation to its advantage. But it's hard to see what the end game here is. Their approach to the world is not something that you can really export to other countries and get people to ride along with you in an international alliance. It can be done by force, which it's doing with some of its neighbors, but it's not something that leads to bandwagoning the way I think China thinks it might. The U.S. has a much better case in that regard. We haven't been doing a good job of expressing it. If you look at some of the international polling, the U.S., the global rating of U.S. leadership is pretty close to where China's is. Presumably that gets better, and some of that's a reaction to Trump and his kind of crazy ways. But the U.S. needs to do a better job of telling its story and getting countries to voluntarily go along with it, opposing this real mercantilist approach from China.
Dan, is the end goal here world domination? I mean, I really feel like they don't care about anybody else and that they just want to have a Chinese world. I mean, does it stop at anyone's border?
No, because they will say that they respect sovereignty, they respect freedom of access, etc. They want, though, to have the freedom of action that they believe they have as a superpower that helps set the rules of the system. That's the way they see themselves coming to the table. But we have to understand what they want to bring to the table is largely anathema to our values of rule of law, transparency, democracy, human rights. Theirs is much more of a clientelistic, party-oriented structure that serves that everything is meant to serve the political interests of the party in the state. So that's a political system they want to export because hopefully it helps make party members rich, it helps make state companies rich, and it helps export their debt and tie the developing world into the Chinese economic model.
Which as we face this election, which candidate works best for China? Dan first.
So that's a challenge. For China's Achilles heel is that they cannot attract people to join with China out of affinity. The alliances and partnerships that the United States has is its secret sauce. Also, the ability to attract the best and brightest from around the world.
Do we still have those alliances?
We still do, but they are in tough shape. They have, I think, decades of a misunderstanding the purpose of alliances and building them for the future. And this is not just on Donald Trump, but perhaps Donald Trump was the worst president to arrive at the time of transition for these alliances. And so China wants to see likes seeing Donald Trump be the bull in the China shop. At the same time, they also like seeing Joe Biden.
I love the play on words. God, that was fabulous. He is the bull in the China shop. But he seems to be, he's not breaking things for China.
No, because he's easy. It's purely transactional.
It's purely transactional, and it's purely one-on-one with the president. He doesn't like
exactly.
These multi-party, multilateral, bilateral sort of, he can do one-on-one, but that's it.
And if you believe the account of John Bolton, he's not going to let things like Hong Kong or Xinjiang be the fly in the ointment to going along to get along.
So I think a lot of this will be hidden by the Trump campaign, which I think is running and is going to run on an anti-China message for the next 3 or 4 months. Recall in 2018, during the elections for the House and part of the Senate, the administration pushed an anti-immigration narrative. It was talking about caravans coming up from Central America. You know, the enemy for Trump then was, you know, poor Salvadorans and Nicaraguans. That didn't work at all. He's dispensed with that. Now he's focused on China as the bad guy. It's much more compelling, I think, for Americans. It'll do better than his message from 2 years ago. But it's going to disguise a lot of what's actually going on with the policy. Are we organizing our allies? Are we playing a leadership role? I agree with Dan, and I'd probably go even a little further and say we've largely forfeited our leadership role in international fora because we don't like international fora, which is a crazy approach. We don't even go to some of these meetings where these issues are discussed. We don't use soft power effectively anymore. Yes, Pompeo at the State Department is kind of turned up the burner a little bit on some of the China policies. Much more needs to be done. Who's more likely to do that? I actually think Joe Biden is more likely to do that. He's going to come in with a better and more coherent set of foreign policy supporters who will be able to get things done in a more comprehensive way. That doesn't mean I'm always going to agree with them. Trump has been haphazard. He's working against his own people. His administration is riven by dissent. Every time he brings up the term deep state, that's code for I don't know how to run this thing. So I think if I were China, I'd be hoping for Trump. I'd be a little more worried about Biden.
Okay. You both have seen a number of elections, the cycles, the markets, reaction. I mentioned Steve Perlstein's column earlier and his laundry list of things that a blue wave would change, which I don't agree with, only because I don't think any administration has ever affected that much change that successfully. I don't care what the agenda is. They just you can't get all of that sort of stuff done in Washington, though. Again, I can be surprised. Jim Labenthal at the beginning of the Farcast today said, don't despair. The American people adapt. The American people move forward. The American economy adapts. It's changing now. The rules are different. Look forward, don't look backward, and know that 5 years from now, you will be glad you're an American, and you will be glad that you own stocks. Agree or disagree, guys?
Always agree.
Totally agree. Totally agree. Amen and hallelujah.
Amen and hallelujah. Harry, we need to pipe in a little John Philip Sousa in the background here as we do not ever on the Farcast lose faith in America. This is a free capitalistic society. We will somehow through the end of this year have a peaceful transition of power, maybe, at least for some office holders. And the Republic will go on. So don't despair. Never bet against the United States of America. Let us know if we can help you at Farr Miller in Washington. Send us your questions and comments to the Farcast. We are here to help. We believe on the Farcast in free market capitalism. and it's going to be the best path to prosperity. That's what my friend Larry Kudlow used to say. It's what I still say. And we hope that you will remain hopeful, remain optimistic, and patriotic. This is the best country in the world and the best place to do business and the best place to enjoy these remarkable freedoms. Stay healthy, stay well. We'll be back next week with another Farcast. Grateful to Dan Mahaffey, Les Munson, and of course, Jim Labenthal. Thanks so much for being with us. We'll see you next week in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. I'm Michael Farr. See ya.
Thank you for joining us on this week's Farcast. We hope you enjoy the show and we'll share with a friend. A special thanks to Michael's guests, Jim Labenthal, Dan Mahaffey, and Lester Munson. The Farcast is produced by Michael Farr and Harry Jennings and is available for free on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and all major podcast platforms. Please subscribe and don't miss a minute. We'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at farcast@farmiller.com. Let us know any questions you might have and topics you'd like to hear us cover as we produce our weekly shows. We would like to remind you that the Farcast podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered legal or financial advice. Any mention of a specific security should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell, and please be aware that past performance is not a guide to the future performance of any index fund, manager, or strategy. And before you make any investment decision, we strongly recommend you consult with a financial professional to determine what may be best for your individual goals and your needs. And if we can be of assistance at Farr Miller in Washington, please feel free to reach out to me at hjennings@farrmiller.com. We are here to help, and I'll be happy to put you in touch with one of our investment professionals for a review of your portfolio and your goals. Join us next week with our scheduled guest, Jim Urio, and former president of the Richmond Federal Reserve, Dr. Jeffrey Lacker. Go beyond the headlines each week with the Farcast. Wall Street, Washington, and the world.